Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, host of KQED Public Radio's California Report and your moderator for tonight's program. This program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Inforum division, and today I'll be in conversation with San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom. Mr. Newsom was first elected mayor of San Francisco in a runoff election in 2003. And 4 years later, he was overwhelmingly reelected to a second term. As mayor, Newsom shifted the city's approach to homelessness, emphasizing housing with services over cash. He's also championed health care reform, environmental initiatives aimed at reducing San Francisco's carbon footprint, and perhaps most famously or infamously opened the door to same-sex marriage. At the same time, the city has struggled with gang problems and a stubbornly high murder rate. And this year, the city is facing a record budget deficit of more than $565 million, challenging the city's ability, in some cases, to provide basic services. Now, Mayor Newsom has launched an exploratory campaign for governor, and he's here to talk about all that and more. Please welcome him, Mayor Gavin Newsom.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, Mayor, as I mentioned, you have launched this exploratory campaign for governor, and you're out and about talking to people around the city, around the state, rather, outside the Bay Area and within the Bay Area, but getting outside the 49 square miles. What are people telling you? What are you hearing?
Well, it's remarkable. I was up in Placer County, one of the reddest counties, not just in California, but the United States of America. And it happens to be a county I'm quite familiar with. My father lives up in Placer County. He was a judge in Auburn. Many of you may be familiar with Auburn on your drive up 80 up towards Lake Tahoe. And he lives in a small town called Dutch Flat. And I was up there last Thursday night. And everyone said, oh, boy, you know, it's one thing to be mayor of San Francisco. San Francisco values good luck up in Placer County. They said the same thing when we were out in San Joaquin Valley in the heart of the agricultural region. And I referenced those as two examples of the remarkable similarity between those counties and San Francisco County, our county, between Alameda County, between Sonoma County, or being down in Santa Cruz County. Exact same concerns, completely different people, different perspectives, different points of view on a lot of issues. But when it comes down to it, at this time, where we are and the world we're living in and the environment, literally and figuratively, that we're living in, it's about jobs, it's about education, it's about health care, it's about roads and infrastructure and congestion, it's about the environment for different reasons. Up there in Placer County in the Central Valley, it was about water policy. Everyone there, though, is an environmentalist because they care about water and they care about snowpack and they care about our capacity to deal with the needs of the region as it relates to balancing those needs with the environmental needs related to the Delta. Same thing down in Santa Monica County, Santa Monica, and down in southern parts of the state. So I don't want to sound like Barack Obama, but there is something to what he said about red states, blue states, nowhere in the United States, that so much of the punditry and the politics assumes this great divide when in reality there isn't that great divide. And I just haven't yet experienced it. I'm not suggesting everyone there is saying, oh, my gosh, it was great what you did on gay marriage or that fact you're a sanctuary city. But right now they don't care about that, candidly, as much as they care about their jobs and they care about their kids' education and they care about all those things that are happening or not happening in Sacramento. So it's remarkable how similar I think this state is and how we are so similar across those geographic and jurisdictional differences.
I realize you haven't been out there doing this for very long, but have you learned anything? Have you heard something from someone who lives there? And I don't mean a college student who's at Chico State, but, you know, someone who's a farmer or someone who's...
My mother went to Chico State, Scott.
Sorry. I mean, I've got... You know what I'm saying?
Fine university.
I'm talking about somebody over the age of, you know, say, your age, you know, 40, 50, 60.
An old man, yeah.
You know, something that made you change the way you look at an issue, maybe?
Oh, yeah, I think a lot of things. You know, I think the issue of environment, I was joking the other day up where my father, as I said, in this town called Dutch Flat, it must have a population of 20 or 30. I've just never seen more people than that. But there's one place you can eat. It's the Monta Vista Inn. I highly recommend it. I have no ownership interest. I just highly recommend it. About 30 minutes north of Auburn, about 46 minutes on the dot to Squaw Valley. And it's a place that I have been since my early years. And I was up there recently, and the only thing you do up at Dutch Flat at Monta Vista Inn is everyone plays liar's dice. And so everything's decided at the bar. All the decisions of the world, all the problems of the world. So you go up there, and then, you know, it's my father, and you start playing liar's dice, and you start talking to these guys. And I can't remember his name. I'm not Bill Clinton, so I don't remember his name, though I suggest they often made up those names, those politicians. But I remember talking to this guy, and we were talking about what the issues matter. We got into politics, and he had some disagreements around, again, the issue of same-sex marriage, but he's gotten over it because he knows my father. And I said, well, what about the environment? And he said something very compelling. He said, well, I'm not much of an environmentalist, but he did confess, second later, that something just ain't right. Something just ain't right. The seasons, something's just ain't right. The Bear River up there, something's just not right. And I told him immediately, well, you're an environmentalist, or you're concerned, nonetheless, about the environment, because something is not right. And it
what did he
reminded,
mean by that?
What he meant by that is, that he recognizes the same thing I'm recognizing, but just with a different perspective, with a different set of eyes. While we may be focusing, especially with the reports that came out today, about living on a coast and what it means for sea level rise and what it's going to mean ultimately if we see the polar ice caps melt, we're environmentalists, but for different reasons. He's an environmentalist for different reasons. And he relies on those seasons for his business. And he cares deeply about the environment, but for different reasons, but he would never call himself an environmentalist. And so for me, Scott, that was profound. Again, it was a distinction that I think is an important one, that we're not so dissimilar. He may be identified, and he certainly is, as a Republican. He may have very strong opinions about government and government's role, but at the end of the day, the common set of values are remarkably similar. He cares about his family, he cares about his kids, he cares about his environment, he cares about the quality of his community and his life. And I think those are things that unite all of us. So I just don't buy these myths. I'm not buying into this whole notion that we're so different. I don't accept that. I really haven't experienced it yet, except for campaign commercials.
What do you think? What do you think is the biggest advantage and the biggest disadvantage of being mayor of San Francisco and running for statewide office?
Well, you know, I think the biggest advantage is I'm the only mayor of a county in the United States of America. And there's a major distinction. City mayors have a limited portfolio in terms of just police, fire, public safety issues, and transportation. I'm simplifying it. But counties have a much broader function. And it's very similar what the state does. It's health and human services, it's welfare, it's issues associated with aging and graying populations. It's a much broader portfolio. And as mayor, it's remarkable that intuitive nature of just looking at the state issues and then being able to look at them from a county perspective and looking at them, I think, with a fresh perspective, but not in any way, shape, or form being unfamiliar with the issues. And so being a mayor of San Francisco, a city and county, is, I think, a huge advantage. The down advantage is purely a political one, obviously. Look, I get it. People love to mock and people love to mimic San Francisco. Different perspectives, different points of view, because we're always on the leading and cutting edge. And good people can disagree. You know, when it was domestic partnerships, people thought, my gosh, these guys are extreme. Now domestic partnerships look so bloody conservative, everyone's rushed to civil unions. And that's a moderate point of view, and I think eventually they'll adopt similar thinking as it relates to full equality. I can go through a litany of issues where San Francisco was on the extreme, but now we're part of the mainstream. And I think that's the spirit of our city, and I think that's also a great advantage, though obviously a liability for some.
Do you feel like you have to dismiss or answer myths about you being from San Francisco and therefore you must believe in X, Y, Z? Or,
yeah.
I mean, is there a way you have to distance yourself from the city?
No, I don't distance myself from things I believe in.
I mean, one thing you've been quoted as saying, for example, is that there's nothing inherently unique about San Francisco. You would never say that in San Francisco.
No. But I wouldn't, because I never said that. I said there's nothing inherently unique in San Francisco, that distinguishes itself so dramatically from what makes California so unique. That was the full statement. Meaning, people say, oh, you can do universal health care here because you're a wealthy city. You know, what a dismissive statement, meaning that's easy. Well, you go down to Los Angeles County, they invest arguably more in terms of public health and their community clinics alike. Don't suggest for a moment that there's something inherently unique about our city and county function that doesn't exist in other counties across the state. For that matter, people say, well, you can balance your budgets. We don't deficit spend. We don't borrow and spend. We don't tax and spend. Only you can decide to tax, and we can't legally borrow. And they say, well, you're able to do that because you don't have all those set-asides and all those formulas that the state has. And I say, well, excuse me, quite the contrary. We invented set-asides in San Francisco. I mean, we truly did. We were the first children set aside. Baseline funding for libraries, baseline funding for police officers, minimum number of staffing and numbers of fire stations. I mean, this is a city. You want set asides. We've mastered that, yet we're still able to invest in universal preschool, the only city in the state of California that does that. We're still able to do universal health care, the only city in America that does that. We're able to go, and I could give you a litany of other things we're doing with those same constraints and limitations. California is a wealthier state than San Francisco is a wealthy city. That's what I was making in terms of the distinction. It's not an excuse. And I think people need to disabuse themselves with these limiting beliefs. And I think our bar is extraordinarily low in terms of what we believe we're capable of doing. And I remember the old Michelangelo line said, the biggest risk is not that you aim too high and miss it, it's that you aim too low and reach it. And I think the genius of our city, the spirit of our city, is about always being audacious, being bold, and stretch goals. We don't always reach them, but at least we have the power and purpose of attempting to try new things and innovative things. It's a spirit of city. It goes back to our founding 150 years ago.
You want to be governor of a state that has enormous problems, and many people feel that in some ways California is dysfunctional as a state. We have a huge problem with our budget. We have a structural deficit that seems insoluble. This tax structure, many say, needs to be completely reformed. It's difficult to pass a budget. We're one of three states that require a two-thirds vote. How would you go about changing the dynamic in Sacramento?
Every single thing you just said, with the exception of the two-thirds, is repeated every single day down at City Hall, and was when you were there, Scott. You talk about dysfunctional city, can't be managed, all these rules and regulations, structural budget imbalance, all the special interests. I mean, special interests. Again, don't think just of the state, think of San Francisco. Yet we're able to manage, we're able to function. It's a different party system. Here, it's ideological. It's not, it's gradations. We're all Democrats, right? So it's an extreme. Are you a progressive Democrat, a liberal Democrat, or a moderate Democrat? And when you're so similar, then it becomes a politics of personality, right? When you agree on 98% of the issues, what do you have to disagree? Oh, it's process. It's personality. He said, she said. So, Scott, it's a way of answering your question quite specifically. I don't think there's anything particularly extraordinary about the state's problems that aren't extraordinary about problems in cities and counties across America. I'm not naive to this by any stretch of the imagination. We have structural constraints around taxes. We have taxes that other cities don't have. We don't have taxes that other cities do have. Utility user taxes for residential use. We have payroll tax on the business side that others don't. So, you know, all these things are unique, but not completely dissimilar. So I don't think there's anything unique except that two-thirds margin that Arkansas and Rhode Island share, which I do think needs to be reformed. I think it's absurd, the notion of two-thirds to pass a budget, but just 50% to change a constitution. How that makes any sense whatsoever. It's beyond me. So I'd like to see that reduced. But beyond that, I don't think there's anything magical about this.
I think it's fair to say that, at least, especially in your first term, you had rocky relationships with the supervisors. And you could point to any number of reasons for that, some of which, you know, I suppose you would take responsibility for some of that.
Yeah.
In Sacramento, we have a situation where even a Republican governor can't seem to get more than a couple of votes for his budget. How would you reach out to Republicans and be more effective doing that than someone in your own party?
Scott, even with all the dysfunction of, you know, again, everyone's consumed with process and personalities. Remember my argument. when you agree on so many things, what's left to disagree about and write about and talk about?
But that's not a problem in Sacramento.
Not a problem. It's existent everywhere, but it's not a problem as much as Sacramento because of the more acuity of the extremes in terms of the different parties. But I say this, and the reason I'm saying this is for this reason. We had almost every – I passed every budget unanimously with that board of supervisors. What matters more than that document? In fact, I joked. I said we did pass every budget unanimously, even though I've had one dissenting vote. But that's unanimous at City Hall. I mean, it's just one vote you're never going to get, and we never received it, at least in the last two budget cycles. The point is we made tremendous progress in those first few years with that old board. So all that chatter, all that who's up, who's down, all that rhetoric, all the public opinion polls of the day for you mattered to nothing. What mattered was the work that was done and the accomplishments that we together advanced were very meaningful, and I'm very proud of it. I can bore you with all kinds of details on a working families tax credit, our Bank on San Francisco strategy, a new 311 call center. I could talk about getting 9,000 human beings off the street that were formerly out on the street as homeless. I could talk about the greatest expansion of affordable housing in our city's history. I could talk about more reforms on foster care and child care and the partnerships we've advanced with public education and the school districts and the work we're doing with institutions of higher learning. I can literally give you a litany, getting the California Stem Cell Institute here, putting together workforce training programs and economic development programs that I think are the envy of the nation, putting together a set-aside for a rainy day fund, having our bond rating increased while the state's was decreased. This is in that dysfunctional environment. So I think I have some experience working together with people that I don't always agree with or sometimes don't appear to get along with, but at the end of the day, we put aside those differences to advance the collective wisdom in terms of the principles and policies that unite us. And that's the end of the day what it's all about. The best politics is a better idea. And the problem in Sacramento is we have an absence of new ideas. And if you are hearing some audacious and extraordinary ideas, let me know, because I'm out there seeking them. It's one of the reasons I'm doing town halls all up and down the state. And I'm not finding a lot of them, with all due respect, coming out of Sacramento right now.
I want to ask you about gay marriage. It was heard.
Shocking.
The oral arguments were heard. We'd be disappointed if
we
were talking
about it. You know, only two people have asked me in 10 town halls about this. I mean, just, again...
Are these audiences open to anybody?
Yeah, no, they are. And in fact, they notably are. People, I the first person asked me was an IHSS worker, in-home support worker. And she said, I want to thank you very much, Mayor. I was married to my partner, and she's here. And then immediately she basically said, okay, that was yesterday. Are you going to cut IHSS from the budget like Governor Schwarzenegger just did? I thought, that's what she cares about. That's what most people care about. I think this issue is a very different place than it was 6 months ago, after what we call Lehman Day in September, when Lehman Brothers went out. I think the world has changed dramatically, but you have a question.
Well, I got a couple. You were featured prominently in the Yes campaign, as I think
recall.
You may have noticed.
Whether
yeah.
I liked it or not.
Whether you like it or not, yeah. And also the wedding you performed at City Hall, the lesbian teacher whose students came.
Yeah, it surprised everybody.
Yeah. What did you learn from that?
Well, I learned that you have two choices in politics. You can be yourself or you can be somebody else. And I learned that I prefer to be the guy that made a mistake saying whether you like it or not than the guy that just sits there and plays in the margin. I'm not going to play it safe. I'm going to be authentic. I'm going to be myself. You may not like me, but you know where I stand, and I'll fight for you. You know, when I gave that speech about whether you like it or not, no one paid attention to what I actually was talking about. I was talking about the history of the civil rights movement and the fact that whether you like it or not wasn't public opinion that advanced the rights of women, wasn't public opinion that advanced the rights of minorities. Whether you like it or not, it was the courts. And I was referring to the 1967 Loving versus State of Virginia decision where 16 states were denying interracial marriage, and the activist court, the U.S. Supreme Court, decided to adjudicate that those laws were unconstitutional and overturned those remaining 16 laws banning interracial marriage. 1967, not 1927. Not 1947, the year of my birth. And I said, in the context of saying that, that 70% of Americans, 70, opposed that decision. 70% of Americans opposed interracial marriage. Interracial marriage. in 1967, whether you liked it or not. And so I learned the importance of reflecting that every word you said will be taken out of context, and including statements. You asked me, well, you said this, but it was not the total context. And that's the nature of politics. I understand a good fight, and I congratulate and honor their campaign for running an effective ad. I thought it was effective.
Do you think it was?
I had to just stand there and accept it and learn from it.
Yeah. If you had it to do over again, would you do that wedding
in front
of the media?
Yeah, I got a lot of time. I went on a radio show, and in this consumed. We were talking about this, and the entire hour was consumed by how people were outraged because I said yes. And here's why I said yes. Because two people that loved each other asked me to perform a wedding, which I do every single week without exception. I've been doing for 5 years as mayor. And I said I'd be honored to do your wedding. And they came in, and we did it, a beautiful ceremony. It was spirited and extraordinary. Won a dry eye around. It was on the balcony in City Hall. And then I walked back to my office. They walked downstairs outside of City Hall, and they were surprised by a group of young kids that went there on a field trip to celebrate with them. Now, the question is, would you do that again? Well, what did I do? I performed a wedding, which I do all of the time. And, you know, if I had known that kids were going to be leaving school, I said, that's not right to have kids go to school for any political purposes, so I don't condone that. I said that. But I didn't know that. How would I have known that? And they didn't even know that. They walked outside. It wasn't even in City Hall. It was on the steps of City Hall. So, you know.
Did you feel, you sort of laid low for a while after that?
No,
that was my
I didn't.
Impression.
I didn't, no.
No, you didn't
no.
feel, you didn't get criticism
no.
from within
oh,
the,
I always
the
get,
no campaign?
Of course, no. I mean, everyone, yeah. I mean, I'm sure they did, but no one called
me. Not to your
me
face.
To tell me. No, yeah. I mean, but I'm, if you fought for something and you believe in something, and if you really actually believe in something, you believe in someone's fundamental rights, and someone asks you to do something that is the most extraordinary thing in their life, besides, I imagine, and my wife just walked in, having a baby and being there at the birth of your child. But the idea that someone wants to share that moment, that experience of something that's been denied them their entire life, and they want you to share that and to say no because I'm worried about my politics is everything I'm not about. If I was worried about politics, I would never have done this, ever. You think it's helped in the context of all these other... These guys are running around, all these politicians, on this. I mean, this is politics today. And it's worse in the Democratic Party. I get in so much trouble for saying this, but I've said it, and I'm going to continue to say it until things change. And this is one of the reasons I'm not favored nation status at the conventions, and I get that. But I'm proud of my party because we've always stood on principle. We fought for civil rights when it was politically unpopular, and folks said we'll never regain the South, and they were right. But it was principled. We fought for labor rights. We fought for human rights. We fought for the rights of minorities historically. That's what makes this party such a profoundly important party. And that's what I've always embraced about the Democratic Party. And here we are, the 55th anniversary this year of Brown versus the Board of Education, where we're going to all be giving speeches. You watch. Just read the speeches. Barack will give, everyone will give the speech about the principles of separate not being equal, that equality and this march to equality has been a long struggle. And they'll all be saying that in one breath, and then they'll walk outside when you ask them, well, what do you believe about marriage equality? They say, well, civil unions are the same as marriage. How can you argue separate is not equal and then argue that separate is equal, but only if you're gay? It's everything I'm not. And so I know that's good politics. I understand that better than any human being alive. Any human being. Just pick up my emails today. Pick up my Twitters. Pick up my phone. Every single day, people are expressing their point of view about how outraged they are. And every consultant saying, well, just tone it down. I can't tone down something as fundamental as someone else's rights. And for politicians to put aside someone else's rights so that they can get ahead politically, it's not, I mean, you've got a million politicians that wish to do that. I'm never going to be that person. I never will. I don't mind. I never came into this for a career in politics. But one thing I said when I got into office, I said, I'm never going to look back and become one of those politicians that says I could have, would have, should have. There's nothing worse than an ex-politician that says I could have, would have, should have. And there's nothing more insidious than the politician says, I'm with you, I agree with you, and then they go out publicly and say something totally different. And you say, what? Why? Or wait for a public opinion poll and say, you know what, I've evolved on this position. And I just, you know, and again, maybe that doesn't make me as viable as other politicians. But that's fine. I get to sleep at night. And so, no, I was proud to be able to do that wedding. I was honored to be asked to do that wedding. What a gift that moment was, to experience that moment with this couple and their families, their straight families. I'm sorry that it was used against that couple and their families, and they were hurt because of that. And I'm sorry those kids were taken out of school, because that should not have happened. But we're all adults, and I understand politics. And I hope that everybody learned a lesson in that process. But no, I don't regret doing the wedding.
Speaking of families, as you mentioned, your wife is here, and she is pregnant, which everyone knows about, I guess, before your family. Some of your family knew, thanks to the Internet. But have you thought about what's it going to be like either running for governor or even becoming governor and having an infant, having a young, you know, a toddler? Can you be a good dad and do both those things?
Jen, what do you think?
I think that's
going to be an excellent No, it's a legitimate question, but I'd like to see more parents in politics. I'd like to see people with that appreciation for what we're about to go. People are already saying, have you signed up for preschool? I'm like, it's just 3 months into a pregnancy. But I love that, and now I'm thinking, and now I know how you feel. I feel your pain. And so it's already changing my version, you know, my views of the world and my empathy and my capacity of understanding. I think that's a healthy thing. So I think you can do both. And I think people want to see you do both. I think they want to elect someone who's a complete person, not just a transactional political person.
So we saw, I know, not someone that you emulate, but Sarah Palin had, you know, her newborn out on the campaign. I mean, are we going to see the little one out there?
I don't know. I don't know. There's nothing worse, and I'm not suggesting she did this, but when politicians use children as props, it's pretty demeaning and damning. I hope and expect never to do that. I don't know. Can I say something about Sarah Palin? I'm going to get in a lot of trouble here. But perhaps for different reasons, though. She was utterly unqualified to be Vice President of the United States. To me, there's no question about that. And I want to just start with that. I mean that sincerely. You know, she really hadn't thought through the issues. But you know what I do respect? And I think we all have to pay some respect to this. She's not someone sitting on the sidelines talking about the way the world should be, on a couch, watching TV, and just pointing fingers. You know, she got out there. She ran for mayor. You know what? I respect. It's maybe a smaller town, but you know what? She ran for office, and she was one. She won. We may not share the same values and points of view. Trust me, we don't. But I admire that. And she put herself out, and she got out front. And I think that deserves some consideration. I think we sometimes demean people, not intentionally, but unintentionally, when we demean their capacity. I think she's an incredibly bright person and capable. And not to be underestimated if she spends the next 4 years preparing. And I think Democrats will be, you know, we underestimated George Bush. We clearly, not once but twice.
Did he overperform?
We underestimated Ronald Reagan. I'm not suggesting that. But I say this at peril because, you know, 4 years ago, and it ties into the gay marriage issue, doesn't it? Because I said, some folks said, well, you were the reason George Bush won. Some very well-known Democrats said that.
A senator from California.
Yeah, and that was 4.5 years ago. It wasn't 40 years ago. And remember the Democrats? We were all, you should read the speech. We were all quoting from the Bible in 2004. All the Democrats. We started listening to country music. Toby Keith, he's a fine singer. Turns out Toby Keith was a Democrat after all. That was relieving because we all kind of liked him. But remember that. I mean, we were literally quoting from Scripture. And people said, we'll never win a race again. That was 4.5 years ago. Now everyone's saying the Republican Party's finished. The Steele, Rush, Limbaugh debate, it's over. Palin and Jindal's the best they've got. My gosh, it's easy time for us. Be careful. We have to be careful. There was an arrogance that led to this revolt in 2006 because the Republicans got arrogant in Congress and they had an arrogant president that were dismissive. We cannot repeat that same mistake. That was just 4.5 years ago. And I'm very, very satisfied with where we are today, but don't think for a second we should expect that that's our future. The past does not equal the future. And so I hope we learn to be cautious, even with those we disagree with, and not be, as Obama says, disagreeable. Be respectful. And respect and admire people that put themselves out. You may not like them, but most of us don't have the courage to do that because it comes with a lot of sacrifice. And so I admire that in Palin. I know I'm. This is not a popular thing to say, but it's something my wife and I have talked a lot about, and I know it's not politically correct out here to necessarily say it, but something I believe.
Plays well in Placer County.
Maybe it does. Yeah. I didn't say it up there, though. I should have.
Let me just remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom. Got a lot of questions here from the audience. Here's one. What happened to the idea of making public transit free in San Francisco?
Yeah, it didn't pencil out. It was a complete, colossal failure. It was a terrible idea to which I take full responsibility. And you know what? I'm glad I proffered it, because had I not, we would have never done the cold-hearted analysis. And you know an interesting part? We did a real study on this. The biggest concern was this, that it would become, you know, it's like anything in life. If you pay for it, you feel a sense of ownership towards it and almost a responsibility to support it in a subtle, intangible way. If something's free, think about it in our lives, we kind of treat it like it's free. And the biggest concern was that Muni would be overwhelmed by people just riding, jumping off one block, jumping back on another block, hanging out. I mean, there was concerns people just spending their entire day on a Muni bus. But the biggest...
I'm sure some people feel like they do.
They do anyway. Yeah, though, I'll tell you, this quarter, we had the highest on-time performance in 20 years. Highest on-time performance in 20 years. It's a low bar, but the highest on-time performance 20 years. It's moving in the right direction.
What happened to Michelangelo?
But here's, yeah, exactly. Well, that's a point. And that's why we have the 85% stretch goal, which I was the author of Prop E that established that. So I'm very proud we did. That being said, the biggest concern was the capacity would grow to such a degree that we couldn't afford the rolling stock and the operation. That's why the cost of doing it was not the lack of collection on the fare box that was the concern. It was literally the capacity question, our ability to operate the system. So, again, I thought it was a really important idea. And it goes to the point of politics now. The biggest problem in politics today, I believe, I submit, good people can disagree, is not just money and the influence it buys. It's the lack of risk-taking. Politicians are risk-adverse. We are scared to death of a bad headline. So coming up with an idea like that, so it can be challenged and belittled. You know, that's something you usually just don't want to do because you don't want to appear to have been ignorant or so wrong. But as you know, I don't necessarily that problem.
But you could also say that, offering free Muni, I mean, that seems like on the face of it would be very popular. And in a way, it gets to another criticism of you, which is that you say things, sort of throw things out there, and then when they, you know, you haven't thought them through, or when they
give me Scott some examples.
I knew you were going to say that.
No, because I'm just curious what they are.
Well, for example, I think there was criticism of the major housing bond, $100 million housing bond that said you were going to put all your efforts behind, and when the polling showed it was unpopular, you moved away from it.
I literally think you're mistaken. That's a remarkable assertion. In fact, quite the contrary. The $100 million bond was under Willie Brown's administration. It passed, and I was very proud to have been a strong proponent of it. So that one I don't.
But there was another one more recently.
The $150 million bond we were a sponsor of. We helped raise money, and we did a lot of advocacy, and I was never persuaded by any stretch of the imagination by a poll. So, again, I don't know where that came from. But I'm curious, what else you got?
That, I don't have a list, I
no,
confess.
No, but because it's important.
Well, I think, you know, you've heard...
Because, only because I'd like to talk about it because it's an interesting thing because we actually put a report card.
I'm turning on my BlackBerry because
no, it's good because I know some of your friends would love to
share some
of those ideas.
No.
But let me say.
I'm tweeting.
But Scott.
Tweeting.
Yeah, no, you'll get it. Come in and right away. Yeah. They'll say, hey, this, that. But I don't know if you know this, and I don't know if you've seen this. I actually am a mayor that puts out a scorecard online. Talk about transparency. Every year of every single promise I make, every utterance and commitment that I make, every single thing I said on the campaign, every single press release, I have a scorecard. You can go online and see every single thing that I promised, and I publish it every single year so all of you have a chance to see. I don't know, with the exception of Michael Bloomberg, I don't know there's another mayor in the United States that does that. I want you to hold me accountable what I say. And that's why I think it's important to hold you accountable to the assertion of the fact that I haven't followed through.
Fair enough.
On some things.
Fair enough. You know, I turned on my BlackBerry, in spite of the fact that it may ring, just because I get a lot of press releases from your office, which is fine. I mean, I used to do that for a living myself. So
yeah,
I
appreciate that.
I got one today, for example, that you've completed your promise, fulfilled your promise to plant 25,000 trees in San Francisco.
We planted 26,000 today, officially.
Great, congratulations.
We exceeded that goal.
That's great.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
Yeah, there you go. But my point is, you know,
what's wrong with that? I think it's important that people know that.
Nothing wrong with that. But I guess my point is that what people, critics, and I'll just put a name on it, Aaron Peskin, I know you haven't gotten along with him, but there are others as well, who say that you are heavy on press releases and pronouncements and promises, I guess.
But again, let's get specific. I wish he was here.
Let me give you a specific.
Oh, excellent. Did Aaron send this in?
No. I'm not even, I'm not following him on Twitter like I am you, you know, it's a... No, seriously.
What's the example?
No. Well, 2004, you were elected, and rather famously, and audaciously, said that they think the murder rate that year had gone up to 88, and I think you said that if unless the crime rate goes down, people should recall you.
In Bayview Hunters Point, as it relates to gang violence, yeah. I said it was a stupid statement to make, but I'm very happy I said it because it went to my passion and conviction on it.
But there was a while where you were with a lot of cameras in tow, going out to the Bayview, looking at the housing project.
They found me as much as I invited them. But Scott, let me just
finish.
I'd like to answer that. That's
I'm
good.
Sure you do. But I guess the point is that there's a sort of a lack of follow-through. This is a criticism.
Where? What topic specifically?
Well, let's pick Bayview Hunters Point.
Let's do it.
The zip code, 94124.
Yep.
It's got the ninth highest infant mortality rate in the state.
That's right. Prostate cancer rates, breast cancer rates, cervical cancer rates, asthma rates, 7 times higher than the national average.
And yet...
And unemployment that is among the highest of any zip code in the state of California. Health disparities, the likes of which no big, rich, wealthy city like ours should ever experience. That's correct.
Well, and so I would wonder if I realize politicians don't get elected generally talking about things like that or things like housing. It's not sexy. It's much sexier to talk about bottled water and carbon footprints and greening the city.
Except
how do you make that calculation?
I'm so excited about this opportunity because, Scott, I want you to write this down. I mean this sincerely.
It's being recorded.
And it should be, because... So let's go back to the homicide issue. Violent crime's gone down since I've been mayor. Violent crime has. The homicides we've struggled with, just like they've struggled in probably 4 or 5 other counties in the immediate Bay Area. We've all struggled with this. Now, let me be specific. The comment that I made was on KFOG Radio, and I was expressing a frustration because I had a guy who worked on my campaign that was shot, and 2 of his friends were killed, and I visited him in the hospital. And he refused to tell me who did it. And everybody saw who did it. I still know to this day who the person is. And by the way, he was finally arrested on a different homicide, the guy who shot his 2 friends. And to this day, he never reported it. And I was expressing my frustration because I was spending a lot of time in the southeast sector in Bayview Hunters Point, and I continue to. I'm back 9:30 tomorrow morning. I'm out there with the principal of Balboa High School, and we're doing truancy walks. I'm out there a lot, Scott. Just not the press, not so interested 5 years later because of our resolve to try to solve some of the challenges out there. And I said that we have got to deal with this, what I referred to at the time, black-on-black crime. And I was very committed. And I said, if I don't, you should recall me. And it was an emotional statement. But you know what the reality was? We actually substantially reduced the number of black-on-black crimes in the last 4 years. So on that actual principle I was asserting, which, by the way, wasn't intended on that specific, I was expressing general frustration, we actually made some progress. And by the way, homicides are down substantially this year. We're finally turning the corner. And that could change literally in an hour or so. So I'm hardly sitting here promoting that. So I expressed some intensity about that. It was hardly a promise or assertion. It was saying, look, I care deeply about this. I want to do something about this. I'm as frustrated as you are. And if I can't, you'll have a chance to elect someone else, is what I was saying. And they just so, and the public decided by a reasonable margin not to. And they decided to continue down this path. The issue of Southeast Sector is important. You know, today, Scott, we announced $81.6 million to clean up the shipyard today. That's more than all the other shipyards in America combined. That's added to over $400 million since I've become mayor. And that's more than Art Agnos, more than Frank Jordan, more than Willie Brown combined to clean up the toxics, which are the primary reason for those health disparities. We have advanced universal health care to 65% of San Franciscans that were previously uninsured. Guess who that disproportionately helps? Folks in the 94124 area code, African American and Latinos. We're doing fast-tracking our universal preschool program. Who does that disproportionately benefit? Folks in that same zip code, disproportionately African Americans and Latinos. We have a working families tax credit. When I became mayor, I promised to do this. We did this. It's interesting, the 150 things I promised that we did that haven't been recognized, but
haven't been recognized by who?
In the context of the assertion and follow-through question, meaning you make these promises, but you don't follow through. These are all promises we followed through, and I think it's important to recognize that. But let me be specific, because this isn't, it requires, it's a very deep-rooted issue. It requires some specificity. That working families tax credit allows working families to keep more of what they're earning. It's only one in the United States. It disproportionately is it helping African Americans and Latinos. We have something called Bank on San Francisco. It now is a national model. The Clinton Foundation recognized it. It gets people out of check cashing facilities and into relationships where they can get savings and checking accounts for no cost with no minimum balances, second chance accounts. It is a huge success. $28 million has been saved by those that were going to check cashing places now that have those dollars back in their pocket because we did something no other city had done. Disproportionately advantaging the 50% of African Americans in San Francisco that have no access to a checking or savings account. 50%. We have, in addition, spent 4 years, and you know how tough this is, and it didn't happen even in the 4 years you guys were in office. We, in 4 years, have organized, and that's why I took a fifth, to finally rebuild the Hunter's View housing project at West Point and Middle Point. We put up $95 million in a program called Hope SF to begin locally, this is federal property, to rebuild public housing. It's a national model, and it's leveraging tens of millions of dollars from the public and private sector, and a lot of the stimulus dollars will be leveraged into this, to begin to dramatically rebuild public housing out in the Southeast sector. We promised to shut down the Bayview Hunters Point power plant. We did it. We promised to bring green-collar jobs and workforce training programs. We established something called City Built. Hundreds of people are getting training. I created a new classification for kids who are out on the streets and sidewalks with tattoos, with big records. We created these classifications called 7501s to get these kids jobs and to get them off the streets. And I'm very proud of it. And I honestly, I kid you not, and I see the numbers, I can give you another dozen specific examples. So I take very seriously my responsibility to address those issues. And that's why I don't want to appear defensive, but I want to show you my conviction. I'm not willing to accept the notion that we are not following through, when in fact we're not only not following through, we're actually resolved and committed beyond, I think, a lot of understanding and appreciation.
You ever, you know, San Jose actually has a very low murder rate. I think last year was 26, or last year that the statistics were compiled. I don't know if 2008's in yet, but
Their numbers went up last year substantially.
They went up a little bit, but still usually typically 3 to 4 times fewer than, San Francisco has 3 or 4 times more murders than San Jose. Well, have you looked at that? Why is that, do you think?
Yeah, very different demographics, very different city, not the kind of density, not the kind of public housing we have. I can go through a series of reasons or excuses or sort of demographic analyses of that. They don't have the kind of parole and reentry issues that we have in the city and county of San Francisco, for that matter. Oakland has. Oakland had 6,000 people that were brought on parole back into their community with recidivism rates there. They had last year 3,700 people that recommitted a crime, 62% recidivism, just with those parolees coming into their community. We are a gateway city in a city whose population surges. How many of the victims of homicides were not from San Francisco last year? How many of the suspects were not from San Francisco? How good can a job training program in San Francisco be to solve a need for a job of someone that doesn't even live here and comes into San Francisco on a Friday night or a Saturday night and pulls out a gun and shoots and kills someone? So you have to look behind these statistics. The crime rate in the 90s was substantially higher. We saw a significant decline, and now we're starting to see it ratchet back up on the homicides. Violent crime still going down. But finally, I think we've been turning a corner, and
you think
I hope
policing,
it can continue.
Differences in policing have anything to do with it?
I think it's an excuse to say the police department is the criminal justice system. I always think it simplifies it to say the police are the solution to criminal justice. It's education, it's job training programs, it's mental health, it's substance abuse program, it's housing, it's those underlying conditions, and it's prosecution. It's your DA, your courts in terms of adjudication. It's your parole and your reentry strategies. It's all of those things. And it's amazing. Every time we talk about crime and violence, it's exclusively Chief Fong, as opposed to, well, where's the public defender, the DA, the courts, the state, the feds, the school system, the public housing? It's a much more complex thing. It's not a way of abdicating responsibility. At the end of the day, it's me. That is mirrored in terms of performance on this issue, and I understand that responsibility, but I think it sometimes is too simple. We have had more homicides with police that were first on scene because they saw the guys drive by, and just down the block they started pulling the trigger, and they walked right up. I mean, we had tactical units, gang, task force units, Hondo and Solo units down in the Mission in October. We had already saturated the area, and then we had that terrible October in the Mission. We had already done a lot of the saturation work with more visible policing. We did crime cameras down there. People liked or disliked them. We did something called shot spotters. We had done a lot of that saturation, yet we still had that tit-for-tat week where we had 6 or 7 homicides and people felt things were out of control. So it's a really complex thing. The most important thing, Scott, and I think you understand it from your years in at City Hall, I don't look at the homicide stats. I look at the shooting stats. Those are the ones that matter more to me, because it's a quirk of fate that someone shot 3 times and you survive, and you were shot once and you pass away, and you were shot in the leg and you got a blood clot. To me, I'm equally alarmed by both of those incidences. One of the big things that's happened in the last, even last year, is we had a 30%+ decline in these key zones, Bayview, Western Addition, and the Mission, in a lot of the shootings. So that was last year is when I felt we were turning the corner, even though the overall homicide rate was flat, actually went down by 1, was flat. But the significant thing was the shootings. And that's why I felt some confidence going into the first quarter of this year. And we're still holding that down. So shootings to me are a real focus.
Conventional wisdom is you can't get elected governor unless you're for the death penalty. Are you going to talk about that?
I don't know about that. I mean, they say that about attorney generals. And I think the last 4 out of 8 attorney generals, which you think is even more significant.
Well, Jerry's for it now.
But I'm not talking about Jerry Brown. I'm talking about other attorney generals have been against it. And I like how you said now. Evolution is remarkable for a lot of things. I don't believe it. If the death penalty was a real deterrent and you can prove that to me, I may have a different point of view. If you told me the death penalty will save money as opposed to cost us exponentially more, and you could prove that, I may have a different opinion. If you said it was a quick way to justice and there was a guarantee that the person that was being held to the highest standard of justice was actually guilty and there was a way to prove that and you had evidence of that, I may be persuaded. But until those 3 things can persuade me, I happen to have a strong opinion on this issue. And again, good people can disagree, and for the grace of God, go any family member that was a victim of violence in their family. And I can only imagine their desire. When I see that guy in the Poly Class case give the family a finger, I understand it. I mean, I certainly understand their right to desire that kind of justice. It's a difficult issue, but it's just one I've always strongly had a firm belief system about.
Another question from the audience. Can we get some of the stimulus money to pave our streets?
Yes. Yeah, overdue. You know what? I think we need to do more than that. We're looking at a potential stimulus strategy in the city to repave our streets and sidewalks once and for all in November. Because, look, at the end of the day, we're playing in the margins. When I became mayor, we were averaging $12 million a year to repave our streets and sidewalks, literally $12 million a year of general fund. The first year I was in office, we went from $12 million, this was a promise, by the way, in the campaign, hold me accountable, went from $12 to $36 million. 2 years ago, we went to $48 million. This year, we'll do closer to $62, $63 million. So we've dramatically increased our contribution. But we're playing catch-up. You've got close to $500 million of deferred needs with our street sidewalks. Literally 12-plus thousand blocks in the city, half of them need to be completely redone. And we're just doing 600 a year. We'll never catch up. So we're looking at a complete bond, to do $300-plus million and just get this thing done.
But there was a bond a few years ago, wasn't there, that you opposed? You opposed it.
Yes. It was badly written, badly conceived. It did not have the appropriate analysis. And I actually, it's the same reason I opposed the Laguna Honda bond, is just because something is a good idea and it's well-intended, if it's badly drafted, I can't support it. And I may, Scott, because this is important. Remember Laguna Honda? You were going to get a 1,200-bed facility, and you had to just put up $299 million. And I remember I got a lot of people said, you'll never become mayor because you just did the wrong thing. You're opposing seniors. I said, I'm not opposing seniors. I'm actually respecting seniors because I think we're lying to people. That $299 million is not even close to enough. Well, guess what's happened? They did no pre-development work. It was poll tested. Why was it $299? It wasn't even close to the margin of error of what it would actually cost. And what you get out of it is you're not spending $299. You're spending 50% more than that for only 780 beds. And you lost some trust and confidence in government in the process because we weren't even close. We misled you. And that's why I opposed it, not because I opposed Laguna Honda Hospital, quite the contrary. So one of the promises I made when I became mayor is I'll never make that mistake again. And one of the first things I was handed was the San Francisco General Hospital bond. They said, you have to do it in a presidential election in 2004. High turnout. And I said, and they gave me a number, and it was poll tested. It was another 99. And I said, I can't do it. They said, well, now you don't care about, this is an outrage. You don't even care about public health. I said, no, let's do the real work. And so we put up $28 million of general fund money. In over 4 years, we did all the real analysis, the soil sampling, the pre-development, the architectural work, the environmental work. And then we went to you, and guess what? We asked you for $884.7 million. There'd never been a bond like that ever. 8.7? Didn't even round up or down? Because that's what we actually think it's going to cost. And just last week, because our bond rating was upgraded while the state's was downgraded because of, I know it sounds strange, fiscal management at City Hall. And Supervisor Peskin, to his credit, played a big part of that. We all did. We were able to sell $131 million of bonds, and we're going to be ahead of schedule in beginning the rebuild of San Francisco General Hospital. And so I think that's a better way of doing things, not just saying you're for something and throwing something out that will fail, but being for something with the foresight to do it in a way where you can build trust and get support. And that's what we're able to do, 80% or so, close to 80% on the San Francisco General Hospital.
Coming back to the streets, though, because it's a pet peeve of mine. I mean, I drive Mission Street, Folsom Street, Valencia. They are a mess in many places. And it seems odd that we would need to use stimulus money. I mean, it's great that it's available, but what I'm asking is a question about basic city services like paving the roads, mm-hmm. versus doing things like the universal access healthcare, which is important. How do you make that calculation?
Well,
you know?
I mean, here's why you have to do it, Scott. The state keeps taking our pothole and repaving money to balance their budget. They keep raiding the county's money. So what are you supposed to do? I know it's a function of government, but it's a partnership. Your gas tax money is supposed to be used to repave the streets, but they keep taking the money. Federal government's not investing in streets and repaving, so general funds get hurt. Seems to me an obvious stimulus. It's an infrastructure investment. It's real jobs. These are shovel-ready jobs. And makes a lot of sense in the spirit of the times to do something you know you need to do, you know where to do it, you know how to do it, and you know how fast you can do it to take some of those dollars. But we're not relying on the stimulus dollars this year. As I told you, we're doing 60-plus million more than any time in history by a huge factor, Scott, to repave our streets. It's just we can't get ahead. We'll never hit that tipping point. I could literally show you a map of 100 streets we did last year, and if you're on that block, you'll say, hey, the streets are not so bad. But then you drive down, you'll see others. We're actually starting to do some signs. You'll see them. It says, coming soon, a paved street near you. Because I know the schedule on a lot of the streets, including Mission, and no one else does. And so you say, no one cares. This is a debacle. But you wait till after the rainy season, and then you'll start seeing a lot more improvements on the streets. But I think it's trying to balance all those dollars and trying to leverage as many dollars you can.
Another question. Will your office be impacted by budget cuts, most specifically the mayor's office of economic development, I assume?
Well, I mean, the mayor's office took in the mid-year 15.4% cut. We walk our talk. Let's compare and contrast to the other branch of government and what they took
layoffs?
In the mid-year cuts.
Were there
yeah,
layoffs?
Absolutely.
How many?
I continue to take budget cuts. We've in fact, Scott, you'll appreciate this. When you were in the mayor's office, you guys were spending more money than we are today. And we're spending less than the Board of Supervisors on the mayor's office. For the first time, the balance has actually shifted. I don't mean to point fingers.
Not in absolute dollars.
In absolute dollars. You'll love the charts. We'll show you the charts. You'll appreciate this.
Are you putting staff members in departments and calling them?
No, but we've consolidated 11 departments. So you're right. It may not be an apple to apple, but it's not in that way. We've consolidated 11 departments. I've eliminated 6. People don't also know that. So we move things around. I think our economic workforce development office are now needed more than ever. The workforce training dollars to create the local economic stimulus that we've advanced. And I hope you know we're doing a local economic stimulus. I'm very proud of that. We're taking responsibility not just to wait for Obama to get our economy moving again, but we want to move the economy locally. And we have some very creative ideas. And I think someone referred to it as the only big stimulus plan of a city in the state and country. Includes payroll tax exemptions, reducing the cost for purchases of equipment that are unsecured. We are distributing $23 million in zero-interest loans. If this is a liquidity and credit crisis, we want to get those dollars out, doing microloans that are going out on April 15th. A lot of interesting strategy, a marketplace initiative to focus on commercial corridors in San Bruno Avenue and 6th Street, Viz Valley, or different parts of the city. Targeting for facade improvements and ways we can start turning these smaller commercial districts around. A lot of interesting economic ideas.
Another question here. San Francisco is a sanctuary city, as you know. Do you plan on placing that policy statewide? How will that affect the jobs available for Californians, people who did not immigrate here?
I'm well, you don't need to advance a policy that was advanced around the time of my birth. I exaggerate.
1983, I think. Was
85 in 85. San Francisco. Mayor Feinstein signed a resolution called City of Refuge. It was around the issue of concerns in El Salvador and Guatemala. And the refuge strategies started to advance throughout the United States of America. We were hardly the first, but we were one of the first. It was enhanced during the Agnos administration and then further enhanced during the Jordan administration. And then there were subsequent amendments during the Brown administration. We are one of dozens and dozens of cities in the Bay Area and one of hundreds of cities across the United States with a sanctuary city. In fact, you recall Mayor Giuliani in his presidential race had to defend himself during those Republican primaries about why New York had a sanctuary city. And he said it because it actually made people safer. It made people healthier, and it educated people. People more likely to report a crime if they were not worried about their immigration status and being reported to immigration. They're more likely to get immunized if they weren't going to be turned over to a community clinic so that when you're sitting next to them and someone coughs on the bus, you're less likely to get a communicable disease. They were more likely to send their kids to school legally, those kids being here, because they were less concerned about immigration thing. And that was the whole idea of the sanctuary movement. It's something that I've gotten probably more knocks than any politician in America supporting.
Well, it was being abused here, too, though, wasn't it?
I mean, and it was being abused, so I'm getting hit on both sides, which is interesting. You know, the O'Reilly Factor loves pointing out San Francisco sanctuary, and Lou Dobbs loves me in particular. I mean, unbelievable the generosity of his words. Michael Savage, he really won. Actually, no, Michael, that's another topic for another day. Because we stood on the principle, because I support the principle. But you don't need to advance something that exists in every city in the state. But the one question was, should we allow people that commit crimes to escape coordination and collaboration with the federal authorities? Sanctuary City was never conceived to harbor criminals. If you commit a crime, the sanctuary city was not there to protect you. And it was being abused. And we needed to close a loophole. And a lot of folks didn't like that, but we closed it. And it was a loophole that existed before I became mayor. A policy existed before I became mayor. And when it came to my attention, we changed it because I'm accountable on my watch. And good people can disagree, but I thought it was the right thing to do. You commit a crime, that does not give you the opportunity to shield your immigration status or any other status. But anything else, you participate in the life of our city, we absolutely are going to be, I think, a model of support.
Another audience question. We're short on time. What do you think is your biggest accomplishment and your biggest disappointment?
I think the thing I'm most proud of, and I invite anyone to walk through the Tenderloin with me, I do it every week, is seeing the faces of people that have housing that were out in the streets and sidewalks. And I mentioned it's 9,143 people as of last week are off the streets since we started. Greatest housing expansion in the history of our city, supportive housing expansion.
Biggest disappointment. So I'm sorry, we're short on time, so I'm rushing you.
It's really important to me because it's the most vexing issue of all, homelessness and panhandling poverty. And you see it every day and you say, okay, 9,000, that's great, Mayor. I see 9,000 people out there. And that's because we're not an island. And as soon as we have someone else may have just arrived. It's a very challenging issue. It's one of the reasons I'm running for governor. I kid you not, one of the principal reasons. There's been no leadership in the state of California on the issue of the most acute measure of poverty, and that's manifested out on the streets and sidewalks, someone who's homeless, and we need to address that. Second, it's the universal health strategy. They said it simply couldn't be done. There was a focus, Tom Amiano, to his credit, of just requiring a business mandate, but that would have solved it for just 12% of people. The idea that we've now expanded it to everybody, it's not fully implemented. We still have a lot of work to do, is extraordinary. I'm really, really proud of that. The greatest disappointment, a combination of things. I said one of them. I want to get this homicide rate down much lower than it is. I've been very frustrated by it, and I accept it. Another one that was frustrating is we could have been the first city in the United States with universal Wi-Fi, but it got beaten up in politics. And I regret that because I know where we'd be today in terms of dealing with the digital divide, in terms of being on the leading and cutting edge of innovation. And we had it. We had a deal. We had a plan. And it just got caught up in San Francisco politics. And it's just one of those regrets. Not a disappointment as much as just a great regret. Could have, would have regret.
Okay.
You get those questions from that?
No,
the
my
email?
Phone was vibrating. So okay, I'm going to be in trouble here. We're short on time, but I want to. This is a kind of an odd question.
I can stay longer. I'm available to you.
I might get yelled at.
You can turn off the radio audience, and we can stay. I always enjoy this. You used to ask more questions.
You're dyslexic.
Oh, thanks. I think we're running a little long on time.
No, I told you it was odd.
It's been great. I'm a busy man, Scott. Gotta go.
I'm curious because a lot of people like, I think Chuck Schwab is dyslexic.
Yeah, Richard Branson, John Chambers.
Yeah. How has that affected you? How have you compensated?
I don't know.
For that?
It's given me more empathy for special education and the importance of it. I mean this. And to recognize that we're all not wired the same. And that we all have a remarkable capacity to live our lives out loud. And that the importance of arts education and music and theater and about building self-esteem and self-worth. That sometimes it's not just math and science. If you're not excelling, it doesn't mean you're not smart, not creative, and don't have something to add in value. And the importance of not just teaching to a test. No Child Left Behind and the like. And And so, you know, I think it's been, for me, very empowering, and it's very liberating, because you overcompensate in different ways. You know, I'm not a speed reader, but I have ability to retain a lot of numbers and to retain a lot of facts, and sometimes that overburdens sometimes my message, but I take that very seriously because I know you're all going to hold me accountable to all these numbers. And so there are ways where you, and I found, you know, I started a business, and I always was aesthetically driven. And I wonder where that came from, and I'm convinced it was the dyslexia. You know, I started 14, 15 businesses, a couple thousand jobs, and I look at these businesses, I say, boy, that's it. Where'd this come from? And so I like, and that creativity has, I think, led to me not just believing in limitations and believing that things can't be done. I still don't know what I don't know, and I love that, the beginner's mind. That Roger Bannister theory of the world. Remember, he broke the four-minute mile. No one in human history had ever broken it. And a year later, three dozen folks around the world broke it. It was a limiting belief system. And so when we talk about universal health care, they said cities can't do it. It's a limiting belief. You can't move people from a cash-based system of care to a service-enriched system of care. Limiting belief. You can't begin to address public education without taking over public schools, and you can't build a partnership because they're two different cultures. We've proven them wrong. I think a lot of these things, and I just think it's important. I think it's the great thing about Obama. I'm convinced he doesn't know what he doesn't know. He actually thinks he can solve the energy crisis, solve the education crisis, solve the issues in Afghanistan and Iraq, and take care of Guantanamo and deal with stem cell research. All of this within the first 60 days.
That sounds like a backhanded compliment.
It's not. He just may be able to do it. No one else thinks he can, but he doesn't think he can. And that's,
doesn't think he can't.
He doesn't think he can't. He actually thinks it's essential. You can't talk about healthcare and not talk about the economy, or talk about the economy without talking about healthcare and education. You can't. I mean, you want an economic development strategy, it's a workforce development strategy, it's an education strategy. Healthcare, that's bankruptcy. Any business people out here know healthcare is your number one concern. You look at the municipal budget, you want to know why our big deficit? We were spending in 1998 $44 million for health care and for our employees. This year of general fund, this year will be $145 million. That's a $100 million gap from just 10 years ago. I mean, these are just runaway costs. You can't have a vibrant private sector economy or a public sector that is vibrant without getting control of health care. So I think this guy just gets it. But I love the fact that he's audacious and he actually believes that all this can be done. And I think that's a great gift, and we should take advantage of that. I think it's, you know, it's the folks that say, oh, I know better. Oh, no, just one thing at a time. It's the tyranny of or versus the genius of and, that we can do this or that as opposed to doing this and that. And that's the spirit of our times.
All right. Well, Mayor, thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for having me.
We also would like to thank our audiences on the radio and here in the room. Today's program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Inforum Division. I'm Scott Schaefer. Now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.